Hub History, the show where we share our favorite stories from Boston history. This is episode 72, Boston's first and only Rat Day. Hi, I'm Jake.
And I'm Nikki. This week, we're going to discuss a civic organization called the Boston Women's Municipal League. They were a group of mostly middle and upper class women at a time when most women didn't work outside the home. And in 1915, they declared war on rats. Over the next few years, they published literature on eradicating rats, carried out an extensive education campaign, and in 1917, hosted a citywide Rat Day with cash prizes for the citizens who killed the most rats. Imagine the fictional Whacking Day on The Simpsons, but with rats instead of snakes.
We'll break their backs, gouge out their eyes, their evil hearts we'll pulverize.
Oh, Whacking Day, oh, Whacking Day.
But before we talk about Rat Day in Boston, it's time to take a look at this week's featured historic site and upcoming event.
For our featured historic site this week, we're visiting an old favorite in Southie. Castle Island is a landmark for anyone approaching Boston by air or sea, and it's a favorite destination for swimmers, sunbathers, and windsurfers during the warmer months. All year long, the causeway that wraps around Castle Island and the adjoining Pleasure Bay is crowded with runners, cyclists, rollerbladers, and strollers, both kinds, as people enjoy the salt air and $1 million view of the harbor. With all that fun in the sun, it's easy to lose track of how important Castle Island is to the history of Boston. To imagine the importance of Castle Island in Boston history, one first has to imagine the geography of Boston Harbor in the early days. Today, Castle Island is no longer actually an island, as landmaking has connected it to the mainland and completely reshaped the coastline of Boston. When John Winthrop and his Puritan settlers arrived in 1630, much of what's now Boston was an archipelago. Castle Island was one of the smaller islands, but it stood right on the mouth of the Inner Harbor, along the only navigable shipping channel. The fledgling Massachusetts Bay Colony felt very isolated, with a powerful colony belonging to the hostile French to the north, and the potentially hostile Dutch New Amsterdam to the south, separating them from the English settlements in Virginia. To protect the town of Boston from an attack by the powerful French, Dutch, or even Spanish fleets that controlled the Atlantic, Governor John Winthrop funded the construction of a rudimentary fort on the island in 1634. The first fort on the site had mud walls coated with a primitive cement made of lime extracted from burnt oyster shells. A handful of cannons were mounted to defend the harbor against any attack from the sea. Despite this humble construction, the fort was soon nicknamed the Castle, an appellation that has stuck for almost 400 years now.
Soon after it was completed, the castle fell into disrepair. In the mid-1640s, it was rebuilt with 10-foot-thick walls made of stone and timber and backfilled with earth. This marked the beginning of a 200-year cycle of neglect and repair that continued until after the U.S. Civil War. The fort was rebuilt and expanded in the 1670s after a fire, and it briefly served to imprison the royal governor Edmund Andros after the Massachusetts militia staged a coup and deposed him in 1689. You can hear that story in Hub History, Episode 6. The fort was rebuilt again in 1692, and at that point, it was officially named Castle William after William of Orange took the English throne in the Glorious Revolution. Castle William was expanded at the turn of the 18th century, then again in the 1740s, making it capable of mounting 120 guns. By the time tensions began to rise between colonists and royal officials in the 1760s and 70s, Castle William was a visible symbol of British civil and military power in Boston. During the Stamp Act crisis, royal officials, from customs agents to Royal Governor Thomas Hutchinson, would take refuge at Castle William when riots and mob violence broke out in Boston. A few years later, after the Boston Massacre in 1770, the people of Boston demanded that all British troops be withdrawn from the town of Boston to Castle William. Officials resisted the move, but there was a real danger that the full fury of the Boston mob would be unleashed on any troops who remained in town. Lieutenant Governor Andrew Oliver had witnessed the power of the mob in 1765 when his home and office were destroyed and he was forced to resign his position as Stamp Act Commissioner. Oliver wrote that if the soldiers stayed in Boston, that they would probably be destroyed by the people, should it be called rebellion, should it incur the loss of our charter, or be the consequence what it would.
When these simmering tensions erupted into open warfare with the battles at Lexington and Concord in April 1775, Castle William became an important stronghold in the British defense against the Patriot forces who laid siege to Boston. According to the Massachusetts Historical Society, only once in nearly 375 years were the guns mounted at Castle Island fired in anger. On March 20, 1776, near the end of the Siege of Boston, the British garrison opened fire on a rebel work party on Dorchester Point. Unfortunately, the Americans were out of range, and one British cannon exploded, wounding seven of their own soldiers. When the British began evacuating Boston on March 17, 1776, they recognized the value of the asset they were leaving behind. Instead of allowing the castle to fall into Patriot hands, they laid explosives and set fires on March 20th, destroying as much of the fort as they could. The Patriots were no dummies, and they also recognized the fort's strategic position, so they immediately began building a new fortification on the site. This incarnation of the fort was designed by Chief Engineer Richard Gridley, officially named Fort Adams, and the garrison was officially commanded by Colonel Paul Revere. During the administration of President John Adams, the fort was officially renamed Fort Independence, perhaps because John Adams was embarrassed to have a fort named after him. A few years later, at the turn of the 19th century, you guessed it, the fort was expanded and reconstructed yet again. By the end of the War of 1812, however, the fort was basically abandoned. After 2 decades of neglect and disrepair, construction of the current fort began in 1833. The U.S. government was implementing a coordinated system of coastal defense forts that would stretch from the Penobscot River in Maine to Key West, around the Gulf of Mexico, and up the Pacific coast to San Francisco. This revised Fort Independence was built out of Rockport granite with walls 30 feet tall and over 5 feet thick. It mounted 96 massive guns, many of which could hit a target over 3 miles away. Though the fort was garrisoned throughout the Civil War and used as a training camp for soldiers who would fight in the South, the fort never saw action.
By the 1850s, the defense role of Fort Independence had mostly been taken over by the larger, more heavily armed Fort Warren on George's Island, while the more powerful guns and steam-powered ironclad ships developed during the Civil War rendered stone forts obsolete. During the 1890s, the city began filling the salt marsh between Castle Island and South Boston, with the goal of creating a broad parkway that would connect to a series of parks around the fort. The U.S. government turned the fort over to the city of Boston, though it did briefly reactivate the fort for service in the Spanish-American War and both World Wars. Most recently, it served as a station where departing Navy ships would have their hulls partially demagnetized before leaving the harbor to make them harder for enemy ships to detect. Today, Castle Island is administered by the Department of Conservation and Recreation. You can get to Castle Island by taking the 7 bus to Marine Park along Farragut Avenue in South Boston, then walking across the park and along the water. There's also parking available at the fort and along Day Boulevard, but it fills up quickly on nice spring and summer days. Free tours of the fort are available at 6 p.m. on Thursdays, as well as every half hour from noon to 3:30 on Saturday and Sunday. While you're there, be sure to visit Sully's for a hot dog or lobster roll. Their late February season opening is always a hopeful sign of the coming spring for Bostonians. As Sully's enters its 67th season, this local institution is in a more solid and substantial structure than the tiny concession stand that first opened in 1951. Their current building was built in 1986 of sturdy brick and is meant to mimic the officers' quarters that once flanked Fort Independence. The line is often long, but it's worth it for some hot, greasy food followed by a generous portion of soft serve.
And for our upcoming event this week, we have a talk on March 29th presented by Historic Newton that harkens back to one of our early episodes. Last February, episode 17 introduced the idea that Bostonians of the late 19th century widely believed that the Charles River Valley had been settled by Vikings 1,000 years earlier. A wealthy baking soda magnate named Eben Horsford helped spread this belief, saying that there was once a great Viking city in Newton called Norumbega, and believing that he had found Leif Erikson's house just outside Harvard Square. The Newton Free Library currently has an exhibit called Romance of the Vikings that explores the 19th century Viking craze, and this talk will be held at the library to complement it. Host John Horrigan is a New England historian, multiple Emmy winner, and host of The Folklorist on New TV. Here's how Historic Newton describes the event. Learn about the Harvard professor Eben Horsford, who was at the center of the Viking craze of the late 19th century. There is no solid evidence that the Vikings actually visited this region, but the public like to imagine connections with the brave Nordic explorers and warriors. Review Horsford's claims that the Vikings sailed up the Charles River and settled in the area over 1,000 years ago, and why he commissioned a tower to be built in their honor. Horrigan will also give a retrospective of Norumbega Park, the popular totem pole ballroom, and the historical Waltham Watch Factory. The event will be held at the Newton Free Library on Homer Street near Newton City Hall at 7 p.m. on Thursday, March 29th. It's free, and registration is not required. The library is located on the route of the 59 bus, or just about a mile from the Newton Center stop on the D line. And with that, it's time to turn to this week's main topic.
On February 13th, 1917, a man who newspapers would identify as Mr. B. Rimkus walked into a city-owned yard in Brighton and presented an official from the Boston Sanitation Department with a sack containing 282 dead rats. In return, he got a bounty of $150, which would be the equivalent of about $3,200 in today's money. Mr. B. Rimkus was the champion rat killer of Boston. But before we talk about Mr. B. Rimkus, let's start at the beginning. Way back at the very beginning. The black rat likely evolved in Southeast Asia between 1 and 2 million years ago, then colonized South and Central Asia. When ancient Rome began trading with India for spices, Rattus rattus, the black rat, hopped on a ride on one of their caravans and made its way to Europe. Rats of all kinds are opportunistic omnivores, eating almost anything that can feed a person, pig, cow, or goat. They quickly flourished in the Roman world, with booming populations stuffing themselves on the waste of Roman farms and cities. The black rat arrived in the British Isles by the 1st century CE and flourished there for the next millennia and a half. Eventually, however, a new competitor appeared on the field. The brown rat, or Rattus norvegicus, was first reported in Europe in the mid-1500s. A Boston Magazine article published last month includes a description of the rise of Rattus norvegicus. The brown rat's origin story begins somewhere near Mongolia about 2 million years ago, long before the dawn of human history. Once Homo sapiens entered the picture, wherever people went, rats followed, eating their debris and garbage along the way. They trailed nomadic shepherds on the grain road through Central Asia and followed the merchants of the Silk Road west toward Europe. They even hitched a ride to the New World as stowaways on ships carrying early European immigrants. The black rat had a head start, but the brown rat had soon supplanted it in Great Britain. Brown rats were better evolved for the cold, and they were larger and more aggressive than black rats. In addition, the changing nature of human settlements in England favored the brown rat. Black rats evolved as arboreal, tree-dwelling creatures. This served them well when European dwellings were primarily made of wood with thatched roofs. As more buildings switched over to brick and masonry with tiled roofs, the advantage switched to brown rats. They had evolved as burrowers and naturally chose damp soils along riverbanks to make their dens. This behavior transferred easily to damp privies, sewers, and basements, and the brown rat was soon the king vermin of the British Isles.
The same transition happened in the New World in general and in Boston in particular. The black rat arrived on our shores with the first European settlers. Any ship from Europe carrying livestock, food stores, or even just the rations to feed the sailors aboard probably had Rattus rattus hiding somewhere below decks. After all, black rats are sometimes also called ship rats. Just over a century later, Rattus norvegicus followed them. Boston Magazine notes, "The first reports of brown rats in the American colonies date to 1775, and the animals quickly became regular residents in the filthy, crowded industrial centers such as Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York, and Boston." They weren't the first rat species on the scene. Rattus rattus, the smaller black rat, historically loathed as a transmitter of bubonic plague, had arrived more than a century earlier. But the larger and more aggressive brown rat, better suited for cold winters, easily bullied the black rat out of town and before long claimed the Northeast as its own. Beneath Boston today is a veritable graveyard of colonial-era rats, says city archaeologist Joe Bagley, who's found evidence of rat tunnels on Paul Revere's property and once even unearthed the skeleton of a rat in the North End that died next to a 19th-century Catholic miraculous medal. Nothing, however, can compare with the grisly discovery Bagley's team made in a garden at the Old North Church in August 2016. They were digging 6 feet below ground near a cistern when the first rat skull surfaced, followed in quick succession by a second, a third, and a fourth. "We couldn't quite figure out what was going on," says Liz Quinlan, a zooarchaeologist who was on site that day. "We were essentially pulling out buckets of rats." By the end of the project, they had removed 747 rat bones, which is insane, she assures us. While Quinlan suspects that the rats drowned in the latter half of the 19th century, she can't yet say if they all perished at the same time.
The archaeological evidence shows how firmly established the brown rat was in Boston by the end of the 19th century. The beginning of the 20th century saw the rise of a new force, one that seems like a surprising opponent for the scourge of the rat. The website Mass Moments describes this unlikely team of heroes. In 1908, a group of well-to-do Boston women formed the Boston Women's Municipal League to promote civic betterment. According to the League's historian, the founders believed that housekeeping of a great city was women's work. It was their province to see that the city was kept clean, as it was also their province to see that their own homes were clean. So obviously, the garbage and ashes should be promptly and scientifically removed from the streets and alleys, the markets freed from dirt and dust and flies, and the air cleaned from soot and smoke. The BWML's founders were drawn from the city's most established families. The members were the wives and daughters of businessmen, ministers, lawyers, professors, and doctors. Within a short time, the League had a membership of over 2,000. Their dues funded studies and programs, usually carried out by paid professionals. However, volunteer committee women managed many of the League's activities. Women may not have been able to vote at the time, but the prominent women of the Municipal League were influential in public affairs in the city nonetheless, as expressed in their 1917 mission statement. "The object of the League is to educate and organize among the women of Boston and the surrounding communities an intelligent, representative public opinion which will exert its influence in the public service." With this mission of public service led by women, the Women's Municipal League soon landed on the eradication of rats as a worthy project for their efforts. They researched the topic of rat extermination and abatement so heavily that they soon became some of the nation's foremost experts. They were called upon to evaluate and endorse various extermination methods, and they spread the slogan, "If we have to go to New York for our hats, New York comes to Boston to ask about rats." A card that members of the Women's Municipal League circulated that tried to quantify the dangers posed by rats said, "There are about 750,000 rats in Boston. It costs at least 1/2 cent per day, or $1.82 per year, to keep each rat. Boston is paying some $1,355,000 a year for rats. Can we afford such an amount to support vermin that bring us trichinosis, bubonic plague, and possibly infantile paralysis? Help us to rout the rat." They published literature about rats and rat abatement and sent it to every library in the country, to municipalities in Canada and Europe, and in response to inquiries from Australia, Brazil, India, and Russia. Mayor James Michael Curley and the city's official rat catcher, Edward J. Kennedy, not Senator Ted Kennedy, endorsed their efforts.
There have been outbreaks of bubonic plague in Cuba and in Puerto Rico, then in San Francisco in 1910, and in New Orleans in 1914. Fear of the plague drove the Women's Municipal League to take up the issue of rat abatement. While the now mostly extinct Rattus rattus had been a better host for plague-carrying fleas, Rattus norvegicus still posed a plague threat. Building on earlier public health efforts to eradicate disease-carrying flies, the BWML formed subcommittees to educate the public about the threats posed by rats and means of controlling their population. In 1915, the Women's Municipal League sponsored a 10-day-long rat cleanup, in which they hired unemployed men as temporary exterminators and opened a temporary rat information office on Boylston Street in the Back Bay. The Boston Evening Transcript reported, "Nearly 900 visitors have passed in and out, and it has been an important factor in this campaign, which is an economic measure as well as one bearing upon the health of the community." By 1916, the Women's Municipal League was making rat abatement one of the primary goals of their organization, saying, "This committee, thinking the time had arrived for active measures against the horde of rats which infest the city, inaugurated a campaign for their extermination under the management of Mrs. Albert T. Leatherby. Believing that an earnest effort to reduce a pest which not only endangers the health of the community, but which threatens its economic welfare and commercial interests as well, would find financial support and active cooperation among the businessmen of the city, it was planned to form cooperative rat clubs throughout the various districts of Boston. These clubs were to be used as centers for the dissemination of knowledge regarding the habits of rats, their danger to health and life, and their powers of destruction. Meetings were to be held at which practical rat catchers would give instructions as to the proper methods for trapping, hunting, and poisoning rats, and experts would discuss the means by which property could be protected against them."
Building on these successes, the BWML decided to hold a huge rat day in February of 1917. They would offer large cash prizes to the man, woman, or child who could bring in the most dead rats. They had heard about a recent effort in London that brought in so many thousands of dead rats that their tiny gray pelts were used in new fashion accessories in London department stores. They hoped to make a similar dent in the rat population in Boston, while at the same time educating the public about the dangers of rats and promoting their other rat-fighting efforts. An article from the Royal College of Surgeons describes the major promotional push the BWML put together. With support from the Boston Health Department, local newspapers, trade journals, and religious magazines, the campaign aimed to reach the widest number of people possible. Flyers were distributed in a variety of languages, and 1,000 copies of the striking two-colored poster were displayed throughout the city, including the platforms of Boston elevated railway stations. Window displays were created in pharmacies, hardware and grocery shops, with 1,000 cards distributed by Boy Scouts. Even the United Cigar Stores Company placed one in each of their stores. The committee commissioned the National Motion Pictures Company to produce an educational film titled The Rat Menace. It was favorably received at a private viewing attended by doctors, federal quarantine officers, and city department members. Later, a series of educational slides were shown in local cinemas over 5 weeks, drip-feeding information to the public. Flyers went up around the city in English, Italian, Polish, and Hebrew. Signs in the windows of grocers, hardware stores, and druggists screamed, "Kill your rats! There are 2 million or more rats in Boston, causing annual damages of $70 million and jeopardizing the lives, property, and prosperity of our city." The event was so widely publicized that the National Association of Retail Druggists Journal carried a brief news article when Rat Day had to be postponed by a day. The mayor of Boston was a great admirer of Abraham Lincoln, and he had asked the Women's Municipal League to move Rat Day so it wouldn't conflict with Lincoln's birthday. Boston's official Rat Day, a movement in which druggists are considerably interested, has been set forward from February 12th to February 13th. If the campaign arouses as widespread interest as is now indicated, druggists throughout this section ought to find a heavy demand for rat poison.
We mentioned the bounty that the Women's Municipal League was planning to pay to Boston's top rat killer. However, that wasn't the only thing happening on Rat Day in 1917. The memo that the chairwoman of the Women's Municipal League rat campaign sent to Mayor James Michael Curley reveals the many activities they had planned and the logistics that went into Rat Day. We therefore request of His Honor the Mayor the following assistance: that he shall proclaim a rat exterminating period and announce a day between the specified hours of which dead rats shall be brought to certain appointed stations. We would request that 10 such be named, one each for the districts of East Boston, Charlestown, North End, West End, Back Bay, South End, Roxbury, Dorchester, South Boston, and Brighton. Such a proclamation would be in line with that annually made by the Governor of Indiana, in compliance with the state statutes. That he shall order the sanitary department to provide proper receptacles for these carcasses and dispose of the same, and that one man shall be provided at each station to receive and care for said carcasses. That he shall allow the circulation of our anti-rat circulars throughout city departments and encourage the heads of such departments to see that they are given to employees. That he shall allow the placing of posters about city property, such as the yards of the various public works departments, municipal buildings, etc. That he shall allow the free use of municipal buildings for anti-rat meetings. Recommend to the school committee that it allow the league's anti-rat circulars to be circulated among the pupils of the public schools to take home to their families, as was so successfully done with such excellent results in San Francisco. That he shall recommend to the City Council the passage of anti-rat ordinances, similar to those in force in New Orleans and other cities which have taken such action, but adaptable to the peculiar local conditions here. Having at the beginning of our campaign received the commendation and interest of His Honor, we feel that he will give the above suggestions his distinguished consideration. This document signed, B. Leatherby, Mrs. Arthur T. Leatherby, Manager, Rat Campaign. One note about that. All the women we could find attached to documents regarding Rat Day are identified by their husbands' names. It was the custom of the time, and we just aren't good enough researchers to uncover their real names. That initial B is as close as we came to finding one of these distinguished women's actual names.
With the exception of asking to move Rat Day away from Lincoln's birthday, Mayor Curley seems to have given the League everything they wanted. While there was an information campaign and an attempt to pass new legislation, the media mostly focused on the rat-killing contest. There were chances to win $50 in each of the 10 districts and an additional $100 bonus for the overall rat-killing champion. The Boston Sunday Post reported on the winner and his methods. B. Rimkus is champ rat catcher of Boston. B. Rimkus is a firm believer in the asseveration that any man who can do something a little better than someone else can is on the road to wealth. Often in our younger days, we were told that the world would wear a trail to any man's door, no matter at what remote location he dwelt, if he could make a better rat trap than anyone else. Well, Rimkus doesn't specialize in rat traps, but he knows how to use one. For Rimkus is the champion rat catcher of Boston. If we are to believe the old tale, the Pied Piper failed to collect for the job. But Rimkus did collect to the tune of 150 cold, hard dollars, coin of the realm, simply because on our recent rat day, he delivered 282 deceased rats to the city yard. He won the first prize of $100 offered by the Women's Municipal League and, in addition, pulled down a special prize of $50. How did he do it? Traps, he answered. Some of the kind that catch them around the neck, some of the big wire ones that catch them alive. What do you use for the bait? That's the secret, answered the rat catcher, and turned his back on the newspaper man. The League went out of their way to note that the winner of the contest was not a native English speaker and he only knew of the contest because he had seen one of their Polish language flyers. The American public is prone to be apathetic to actual effort of this nature, and it remained for a foreign-born resident unable to read or write the English language, who would have known nothing of the movement save for the printing of the circular in Polish, to exert himself to trap nearly 300 rats in spite of the weather and the difficulty of getting at the rodents. There is much food for thought here. Immigrants, they get the job done. Second place went to John White of Charlestown, though his 88 rats seemed to pale in comparison to B. Rimkus's 282.
Rat Day and the prizes that were handed out made for great headlines. The Women's Municipal League didn't consider the effort to be entirely a success. They had hoped to see much greater numbers of dead rats brought in, and they had hoped to reach a much broader segment of the population. Unfortunately, as the League's 1917 annual report relays, Rat Day was preceded by a prolonged spell of the coldest weather of the winter, with the thermometer registering at zero and below for some four consecutive days, causing the rats to seek their nests and burrows and remain in seclusion until warmer weather came. This condition, together with some misunderstanding that seems to have arisen that the killing was to start instead of end on the 13th, resulted in a very small bag. The report puts the best face on a project that saw only limited success. As the campaign progressed, it was realized that despite the efforts of the federal and municipal health authorities, the people were not sufficiently impressed with the danger to give the support necessary to carry out these extensive, yet practical plans. And owing to the impossibility of securing sufficient funds to execute them, they were reluctantly abandoned. Rather than give up the work entirely, however, it was decided to do as much as possible with the funds available, and it was believed that while the actual extermination would be slight, the campaign could be made one of education, which might later stimulate an interest in anti-rat measures. Was their campaign a success? In the end, the evidence speaks for itself. There was never another Rat Day in Boston. The League would say, therefore, the campaign was remodeled on the new lines, and while we feel that it was far from being as effective as it might have been had it received proper support, we do believe that a great deal has been done in educating public opinion on the problem, which will result in the passage of rat-proofing legislation and other prophylactic measures against the entrance of bubonic plague into this port. The Royal College of Surgeons judges the League less harshly than they judge themselves. Despite the low number of rats collected, the committee's publicity work had led to additional exposure and advertising by businesses involved in rat control, so the campaign's success was actually much wider. The work was taken over by the Boston Board of Health, and indeed continues to this day. How successful have these efforts been? Is Boston now a rat-free utopia? Well, that Boston Magazine article from last month describes the scene in Boston today. On any given night, thousands of rats are running wild through Greater Boston, gnawing their way into historical brownstones, defecating in popular eateries, and having ungodly amounts of sex in our public parks.
Today, the only places in the world that can claim to be rat-free are Antarctica, a few isolated islands, and the Canadian province of Alberta. Last year, Governing Magazine announced that data from the Census Bureau's American Housing Survey indicates that Boston has supplanted New York as America's second rattiest city. 16.9% of Boston households reported rodent sightings, just slightly behind the rattiest city of all, Philadelphia, which was at 18%. Patriots fans can draw their own conclusions from these findings. The Boston Magazine article continues, in 2016, Boston Inspectional Services teamed up with researchers at Harvard and MIT and began packing large rat nests with dry ice, which evaporates into carbon dioxide and suffocates the animals. The city tested the method on infestations in overgrown cemeteries and even used it on a massive burrow in the public garden. It was amazingly effective, Christopher says, probably the most humane way to deal with the rodents. But then the federal EPA got wind of what was going on and told the city it was not allowed to use dry ice because it was not an officially registered pesticide. Ultimately, though, controlling rats isn't really about coming up with new ways to kill them. It's about effectively managing the endless stream of trash that flows from our homes and businesses, along with making it difficult for the animals to find warm, safe places to nest. It means that residents shouldn't dump garbage on the sidewalk, and that parks departments should know which type of ground cover is hospitable to rats and which isn't. It means that restaurant owners should seal up their dumpsters every night, and that landlords should quickly call an exterminator when a tenant complains. Needless to say, these are lofty ambitions for a city where neighbors get in fistfights over parking spaces and absentee landlords abound. Even if we do everything right, the simple fact is that rats are here to stay. Listen, people. Keep the lids on your garbage cans and don't litter. The Boston Women's Municipal League isn't planning to hold another Rat Day anytime soon, but if they do, I am super competitive and I am totally gonna win. But in the meantime, it is up to all of us to fight the good fight.
To learn more about the Boston Women's Municipal League and their war on rats, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/072. We'll have a couple of news articles about Rat Day, the League's annual bulletin where they share their success and challenges in the rat campaign, and examples of the posters they use to promote their efforts. We'll also have that Boston Magazine article and some other disturbing stories about rats in modern Boston. And of course, we'll have links to information about this week's featured historic site and upcoming event. If you're interested in meeting us, one way to do that would be to register for History Camp, which is coming to Boston on July 7th. We'll both be attending, and I'll be part of a panel discussion with some big-name podcasters, like Liz Covart of Ben Franklin's World, and Edward O'Donnell of In the Past Lane. I'll also be leading a special tour of the Back Bay the day after History Camp for those who attended. So come on out if you're interested. It's hard for us to picture that we have real listeners out there, so it's always fun to have a chance to chat with you. You can find details...
Unless you don't like the way we pronounce Wagner, then you can stay home.
You can find details about History Camp at historycamp.org/Boston.
Before we let you go, we have a special request for you. This year marks the centennial of the 1918 Spanish flu. It was the most deadly pandemic in human history, and it got started right here in Boston. We're going to do a show on the outbreak later this summer, and we'd like to include some of your personal family's stories. Did someone in your family get sick with influenza in 1918? Did they work in a hospital or volunteer with the Red Cross? Did they serve in a military unit whose readiness was affected by the flu? We set up a hotline where you can get in touch with us at 617-383-9255. If you have a story you can tell in a minute or less, just leave a voicemail telling us the story so that we can clip it. If you have something longer that you think we should hear, leave your contact information and we'll get in touch. The number again is 617-383-9255. If you want to share your family's 1918 flu story, or if you want to get in touch with us for any other reason, you can always email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. If you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, please think about writing us a brief review. It's the best way to help others discover the show.
That's all for now. We'll be back next week.